wave antenna with a quarter wave ground plane underneath. It was a sheet of metal, and mounted it up on the table, and it was measuring it, in three axes, X, Y, and Z. And I took that half wave dipole, which was basically strengthened across a little piece of like fiberglass, fed to an N type connector in the middle, and it was trimmed a little bit from the half wave to get, a better match to 50 ohms. The same thing with the quarter wave ground plane. I trimmed it a little bit to get it closer to 50 ohms to get a better match. The loop antennas, I was using a Balun device, a piece of ferrite, where I was wrapping the turns in bifilar around it and using the similar turns ratio to get the match, which got me back to 50 ohms again. It wasn't too bad to do that. And just by adjusting turns, and I could get the, using an MFJ analyzer. So the matches were all good. The cables were good. And measuring three axes, but I guess just all of the effects that you're saying, and the poorness, I guess, of the chamber. Because I was trying to back off the signal on the generator as low as I could go to try to get it to, fall within, the dynamic range of the Rodin-Schwarz analyzer in that chamber was between, like 90 to 100 dB microvolts max, and, the noise floor was somewhere like around 10 to 15 dB microvolts. And the scans I kept short, between 300 megahertz to 500 megahertz, and sweeping across, 449. And looking, for peaks and quasi peaks, and trying to see if I could find correlations between the antenna. But as you were saying, all of the above were definitely hitting me, and they would read very similar over and over again. But the disparities between the antennas that I was seeing were, in a near field like that, I would have figured were, nothing what I was expecting to see. And needless to say, like you're saying, I think that definitely antenna ranges are a much better way to do this measurement than. So I think I'm just going to take a lot of the information with a grain of salt and put it off on the side. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Let's hear a couple of words about the chamber itself, Glenn. How big was the chamber in width, height, and depth? How big were the absorbing cones of emissive-coming material on the walls? That's a spotting factor as to whether or not you stood a chance of making a measurement that gives you any kind of sense at 449 megacycles. And if you try to make any of those measurements at, you did say 10 meters, 30 megacycles, wow. What does that chamber look like, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, see, unfortunately, these measurements aren't even a real 10-meter chamber. It's a GTEM. And basically what this thing looks like is a huge horn antenna. And at the end, you can climb in. There's a little door on the end. And you're basically, there's a table at the end of this this horn type of antenna, and the height at the end where the table is, where you can put your test sample in, the horn, is maybe not quite 5 feet high. So you kind of have to bend over when you're inside this chamber to set something up on the table. And the part where the antenna is on the other end of the horn actually comes down to just a few inches where the little antenna element is on the outside. And all of the antenna is calibrated over frequency to give normalized measurement. And there are no absorbing materials in it. It's basically just a big horn, a big metal horn. And they kind of like calibrate it all out with the Rodin-Schwarz program to kind of give you a flat response so that when you're taking something with a very, very small signal, like EMI coming off of a radiating device, it gives you pretty good results. I was just kind of hoping that if you had an antenna and you were feeding it with very, very low input signal and trying to measure the radiated signal at the output, you could kind of get an idea of what kind of output you were getting from the antenna in X, Y, and Z pattern. But apparently the disparity between the antennas, I don't think, was anything close to good data, Dick.
I have a suggestion for that. Okay, Alex has a suggestion, but before you go there, you said there was no absorber in that GTEM. There certainly is. The whole back wall, the square wall at the largest end of the chamber, which is not open. In other words, you assume that you walk in the side door, and the narrow tapered end where you feed the G10 is far to your right, and the big wide open, the big large back wall that's closed is to your left as you walk through that door. And if you look to that left side real close, you'll see it's got a zillion. Oh, I don't know what they are, 50-ohm resistors, 2-watt resistors. It's got a huge absorptive device made out of a whole lot of individual resistors. And you've got this plate of metal that goes down the center of this horn, that eventually ends up at the throat, where it's fed with a great big type N connector or whatever it is. Now, the way a G10 is designed, it's designed to create, for small objects you put into that chamber, a very clearly defined E field in volts per meter at your operating frequency. And most of these G10s will operate from near 0 megahertz all the way up to near 1,000 megacycles. Beyond that, they start doing some funny moding effects if your object in there is small. Well, your antenna is now being subjected to a nearly pure E field if the antenna is small enough. And I think a 449 megacycle antenna comes close to meeting that criteria. And then as you change the orientation of that antenna, even though the walls, let me think about this now. Yes, the walls are reflective. The front wall and the back wall that you see directly in front of you as you go through that door on the side of the chamber, of the G10. At first they look like they're reflective devices. But because of the mode of propagation of the TEM wave going down that G10 horn-like structure, the reflection off the front and back wall almost doesn't count, except for the minor change it has to the visor of your antenna. The G10 is very sensitive to vertically polarized energy. It sees almost no horizontally polarized energy. I wonder if some of my description comes close to the particular G10 that you were using, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yes, exactly. And I think that was basically the conclusion that I was coming to. I didn't want to mention a conclusion. I wanted to kind of hear your opinion first, was that the chamber has a polarization. And even though I'm covering three axes, depending on the position of the antenna on the table, is the chance of the orientation for that many different styles of antennas of getting accurate measurements with respect to the polarity of the chamber with reflections, it was probably going to give me the error in the overall. So in other words, I wasn't getting a true XYZ summing of all of the signals where I was expecting the energy from, because the level from the generator, if it was fixed at a fixed point and I was just changing antenna samples, I was hoping that I wasn't going to see a huge difference in energy in the chamber, but unfortunately it was all over the place, and I wasn't trusting that the polarization lineup with the different antenna types was giving me the correct results. But I think your description of the chamber was right on the money there, Dick. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
On a quick count, question, Glenn, the table you were setting things on, was that a insulating table, a fibrous table? Go ahead.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, it looks like a wooden material, and it's driven through the floor with a wooden, like, pole, and it's motorized outside the chamber, so that basically you can run it through X, Y, and Z positioning. So in other words, all you have to do is mount it once on the table, lock the chamber up, and basically, you know, move the position of the table, and it's a fully insulated table, so that you're taking all the automated measurements outside the chamber.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you what the G10 was designed to do, and what you were trying to do is a bit of a stretch. Although if you're smart enough in the way the electromagnetic waves behave, you can get some reasonable data out of it. The main intent of the G10 is to create a amount of E field in one polarization only, which is traceable to the bureau. In other words, when you set that thing up for producing 100 volts per meter, and you feed a signal in there at the various frequencies, at the narrow end, the throat of the thing, and you put your object that you're measuring its susceptibility, like a handheld computer will say, and you put it onto that XYZ table, I'm going to call it. It's really a roll pitch yaw device. And now you take your device of the test, roll it in your pitch and roll as you subject it to your signal of 100 volts per meter, if that's what the test has to be, as you sweep it in frequency and find out what its susceptibility is. Does it respond? Does it stop performing correctly? And you can also use it in reverse. You can also find out radiated signals from your device of the test by using the G10 in the reverse direction as a receiving device. And again, you rotate it X, Y, and Z and find out what's coming out of your device on the test. In that respect, it's kind of handy. Very few people have ever used it as an anechoic antenna testing chamber. I didn't say you can't. I'm just saying it. There's very little history in doing that, to my knowledge. And when it comes to the major antenna testing facilities on planet Earth, when it comes to frequencies below 1,000 megs, the smarter one usually start using the parking lot. And they set up the parking lot, get rid of all the cars for a large distance, and they set up the parking lot as a calibrated, reflective, ground plane antenna range. And if you're smart enough in the way you set that up and calibrate it and qualify it, you can get some extremely good measurements out of a parking lot. Now, Alex said he's got some comments on all of the above. Let's see what the man from Yonkers thinks about all this. N2NNU, K2RIW in the deck net.
Yes, Dick, you started to touch on the subject, but never finished it. You cannot get in an anechoic chamber and just put an antenna on it and test. You have to qualify first the anechoic chamber. You have to know what it can do without your instrumentation or without all that stuff inside, or even with it stuff inside. So usually when I do this stuff, and that was a long time ago, I put my test equipment and everything else that's inside, and then I'm doing a qualification of the setup, meaning that I'm taking readings of the echoes inside there, not on my test equip, on my antenna, but on the flooding antenna. I have an antenna that floods inside with the radio frequency, and I make a three-dimensional picture of echoes inside the chamber. Then during the real testing, those echoes are subtracted from the antenna pattern that I'm looking for, and that gives a pretty, very, very pretty narrow response to whatever you want to, quite clean. And second of all, you started to talk about, Dick, about parking lots. Have you ever tried, now hold on to your seat, have you ever tried a food processing plant? That is perhaps the best anechoic chamber. Back to you, Dick.
A food processing plant. I'm going to have to hear some more words on that. Well, let's go back to the chamber and what Alex just mentioned. Let's assume now that I'm using a rectangular chamber. There are chambers that are made cone-shaped, and they occupied a small time in history in the late 70s in which people thought that it was a superior chamber, and they soon discovered it was not. That a well-tuned rectangular chamber usually is better. The rectangular chamber might be, let me pick a number, 30 feet wide, 30 feet high, 60 feet long. At one end of the 60-foot dimension, in the middle of that far wall, you'll have a source of signal connected to a signal generator going into a horn, and quite often that horn is rotatable in polarization, and it's aimed right down the long 60-foot axis of the chamber. At the far end of the chamber, where you do the testing of the antenna on the test, the first thing to do that Alex was mentioning is called qualifying the chamber. You do what's called a field probing operation. You take a small test antenna on some kind of a movable structure, and you literally do a raster scan. In other words, you take the small test antenna while the feed horn at the far end of the chamber is transmitting a signal at your desired frequency. You move that field probe in X, Y, and Z, and you find out where is the so-called quiet zone. The quiet zone is defined as that chunk of three-dimensional space at the, let me call it the near end of the chamber, where you're going to put your antenna on the test. You're looking for a chunk of space that is considerably larger than the antenna you intend to test, and hopefully across that chunk of space, as you move the field probe antenna less than 1 decibel, and hopefully only a couple of tenths of a decibel of amplitude variation takes place, and you'd like to also have less than 16 degrees of phase variation to take place as you scan in X, Y, and Z across your so-called quiet zone. Once you've convinced yourself that with your instrumentation in the chamber, and you're about to put the device under test, you have a chamber that is now meeting your criteria for your particular accuracy requirement. And if you've got a real good system, you maybe recorded the amplitude of the signal and the phase of the signal during the scans, and in theory,
repeater, timeout.
In theory, you can take all that recorded data along with the measured data of your antenna under test and crank out some of the effects of the chamber. Not too different from what takes place inside of a good vector network analyzer. A good vector network analyzer, I don't care what brand it is using directional couplers. The directional couplers are trying to measure how much signal is coming out of port number one and how much is reflecting back into port number one, and the same thing with port number two. Well, those directional couplers have limited directivity. You'd like them to be 70 dB directive, and they're probably 25 dB throughout most of the frequency range. You would like them to have sources that have a signal standing wave ratio of 0001 dB, and then a 0001 magnitude of standing wave ratio, minus 60 dB of reflection of your signal sources, and the signal sources are nowhere near that good. So the bottom line of all this is there is a 12-point correction procedure that takes place where you put a standard short, standard open, and a standard through, and a standard load on the end of your test cables as you sweep across frequency of the frequency region you intend to use. The network analyzer measures all of those apparent reflections and throughput signals of your test device, of your calibration kit, and it cranks out all of that information such that you establish what's called a reference plane at the point where you're going to connect the component being measured with the vector network analyzer. A good vector network analyzer can take out all of the extraneous effects of its instrumentation down to numbers like minus 60 decibels from the level at which you intend to do the measurement. A good vector network analyzer can do that, even though the instrumentation itself has internal reflections that are only 20 dB down. The next 40 dB you can crank back out with a 12-point correction procedure. Well, with a good anechoic chamber, you can do something similar to that. So Alec is going to give me some further words on what I just said, and he's going to tell me how a food processing plant makes such a good anechoic chamber. NQNNU, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so we calibrated our anechoic chamber. The question is now, in what domain did we calibrate it? In reflective or absorptive mode? I think you're talking only reflective. A food processing plant is a very good reflective anechoic chamber. In other words, it reflects so much all over the place that your waves are becoming really, really diffuse. Almost impossible to find a direction in there. And that is similar to white noise. So this is why a food plant, a meat plant, can be used as an anechoic chamber, although the radiation is there, but it's so diffuse that you don't care about it anymore. Back to you.
Wow. Yeah, that one I haven't heard of. In other words, make the echo so bad that they all combine a zillion different ways and it becomes white noise. I still would have trouble trusting that kind of a chamber to the nearest 20 decibels or so. Whereas a good anechoic chamber, you're able to keep the echoes 40 and 50 decibels down. And by the way, when it comes to anechoic chambers, there's at least two or three different kinds of anechoic chambers. And all of that calibration and qualification procedure I described before in the so-called field probing experiment in which you qualify the chamber. You can do that for horizontal and vertical polarization. You can do it for slant 45 right, slant 45 degree left polarization, clockwise and counterclockwise. You'll get slightly different answers in all of those emitted signal types. The chamber itself can be a chamber in which you intend to measure pattern, or it can be a chamber in which you intend to measure reflectivity. In other words, how stealthy is your particular aircraft model? A reflective chamber, a chamber that you intentionally measure scattering parameters of your particular stealthy aircraft, that is a much more severe requirement on a chamber than just a pattern measuring chamber. But even a pattern measuring chamber, because the antenna under test might have high directivity in some direction, like a small parabolic dish or a cavity back spiral, and as you rotate it, it is aiming signals at the walls and the back wall and so on, and any reflections off of those places and the floor and the ceiling could contaminate the measurements, depending on how good is your quiet zone. And by the way, whether the antenna under test is being used in the transmitting mode or the receiving mode usually does not make any difference. That's just a matter of your particular convenience and the way you set up your instrumentation. The law of reciprocity of passive antennas, antennas that don't contain circulators and gyrators and active components like preamplifiers and transmitters, a thoroughly passive antenna, whether you measure it in the transmitting mode or the receiving mode, you better get the same results. And if you don't, you better explain why. Because you'd be in violation of what's called the law of reciprocity. Don't break the law.
Repeater, time out.
Now, I am curious, Alex, how much testing have you done of antenna patterns, either scattering patterns measuring the pattern of the antenna or the scattering effects of a device on the test? How much of that testing have you done in a meat packing house? I expected you to tell me that the meat is an absorptive material and it's anechoic, and I was going to be a bit skeptical of that. So how much antenna testing have you done in a meat packing house? N2NNU, KQRIW.
And now you want the detail. That's too much, Dick. Well, I did it once. I spent about a week in the meat packing plant, and I didn't have anything there because it was a field operation and I couldn't get anything else. I wanted to use basically some containers, empty containers. The 40-foot container is probably the best isolation that you can find. But I didn't find welding instruments and whatnot. As I said, it was a field trial. The only thing I found there, it was the meat packing, the meat processing factory. So I spoke with a guy, and they let me in, and it was really amazing. Well, first time you don't realize what's happening on the screen because of so many echoes flying back and forth, and then suddenly everything quiet. It depends how the meat is arranged. Imagine you have hunks of beef hanging around all over the place, and believe it or not, those are not absorbing. Those are reflective because they basically water, and they're reflecting on each other, and it creates that horrific RF field that is actually annoying. How many times? Once? How long? About 2 weeks.
Now, if your meat packing house was a large enough facility, it automatically becomes nearly anechoic. And let me give you an example of what I'm saying. When the very large chamber was being constructed at Edwards Air Force Base, it was originally called the Air Force Anechoic Facility, AFAF. People pronounced it AFAF. And this was 1989 time frame, when that was first being constructed by the Rockwell Company for Edwards Air Force Base. That chamber was roughly 300 foot square by 70 feet high. So it's an acre and a half of floor space, seven stories high, thoroughly anechoic chamber, tempest proof. I think the walls in the chamber were quarter inch thick steel, welded, and all of the joints were tested for their RF leakage. Beautiful facility. And the way it was constructed, the individual anechoic material that was going to be installed on the walls, in theory, should have been tested ahead of time before installation. But the contractor decided he could save money by just constructing the material, slapping it on the walls, and measuring it afterwards, and prove, by skipping some of the individual steps, prove that the whole chamber is going to work right. And the specification for certain frequency ranges that the echo off the wall was supposed to be 40 dB down. The chamber was constructed, the echoes were measured, and they were not 40 dB down. They were considerably stronger than that. And so they thought the material on the walls was defective. Let me drop. And I said to myself, wow, that's crazy. The wall, when you stand in the middle of the chamber, is 150 feet away from you. That's a frequency of interest. If the wall was made out of a gold-plated piece of steel, and you had perfect reflections off that wall, because the signal would have to go 150 feet to the wall, reflect, and come back another 150 feet, 300 feet of round-trip path, that signal would be attenuated 38 dB, and the spec was 40. You only needed 2 dB of absorption of the wall to meet the spec. You can't make anechoic material that bad. And they were measuring echoes of, let me pick a number, minus 36 dB. I knew it wasn't the echo off the wall. It was the stuff on the floor. The stuff on the floor was being misused. It was aimed at the wrong angle. It took me a month of Sundays to convince people, remove the acre and a half of anechoic material on the floor. They said, you're crazy. This is an anechoic chamber. I said, yes, make it anechoic by removing the anechoic material on the floor. They said, you're crazy. I said, do it. Try it. You'll like it. A week later, they finally got around to doing it because they were so desperate. As long as the testing we're doing was low enough to the floor, the echo, the signals reflected off the wall, glanced off the floor at a grazing angle with very little absorption, then went over, hit the wall, and got absorbed, and you never saw them again. The chamber became more anechoic by removing anechoic material. Because the pyramids on the floor were aimed straight up at the ceiling, and you aim a signal at them so that they hit the side of a pyramid, you may call it absorbing material. And the absorbing material, when you hit the sharp points with the signal, does a beautiful job. You hit the flat sides of those pyramids, and they will reflect back at you. Your absorbing material will reflect back at you if you misuse it. You can use it correctly by either tilting it toward the source, which they were unwilling to do, or remove it entirely. A bare concrete floor was a hell of a lot better. So, if the chamber is big enough, it becomes anechoic. The signal goes away from you, it goes such a long distance before it reflects off of something. By inverse square law, the signal becomes so weak, you think you're in free space. So if your meatpacking house was big enough...
Repeater, time out.
If your meatpacking house that you used in desperation, because you had no other building, you probably were doing testing in the wintertime, you didn't want to be out in the snow and the rain and the wind, you wanted to be indoors, and if the building was big enough, by definition, it becomes almost anechoic if you're smart enough. I think you were using that concept, Alex. N2NNU, K2RIW.
I was speaking about improvisations. I'm not speaking about professional installation. I'm speaking about do with whatever you have to do with whatever you have, whatever you have handy. And I thought to share my experiences with the meat processing plant. Yeah, that was quite large. It was much larger than that. It was at least 100 meters long, probably 50 meters wide. And the tracks on which the meat was running was probably three times or four times throughout the whole plant. So it was quite an installation. So all I'm trying to say, Dick, if you have no anechoic chamber but you have a meat processing plant, use it.
And if you've got a schoolyard that's big enough or a parking lot that's big enough and you're smart enough to know how to calibrate it, you can make a beautiful antenna range out of it. The vast majority of all the antennas used in the United States are designed and used for a function below 1,000 megacycles. All of your television broadcast antennas, all of your AM and FM radio antennas, they're all below 1,000 megs. Almost all the anechoic chambers, antenna testing chambers in the United States, have either yucky or no real performance below 1,000 megs. That means all of these antennas that you buy and have all kinds of ratings that sound like they're traceable to the Bureau, they were either never really measured, or they were only modeled on somebody's crazy computer program, or they were, if they were measured at all, they were measured in a schoolyard or a parking lot, because you don't have very much choice. If you measure them in a chamber, you get worse results than if you measure them outdoors. And the OATS ranges that people use, the OATS range really is a little bitty house made out of fiberglass. And everyone thinks that the fiberglass is going to be a transparent material. The OATS ranges were originally designed for work outdoors at, say, 20 megacycles. And it keeps you out of the rain in this fiberglass little house where everything, all the beams and the walls and the windows and everything else are made out of insulating materials. And at 20 megacycles, it does a pretty good job. But because people needed measurements all the way up to 1,000 megs, these OATS range became a decision of desperation. People forced them to be used at frequencies up to 1,000 megs. And the results they get are really yucky at times. Because, as I've often said, a 2x4 at X-band in free space will give you an echo that is only a couple of decibels weaker than the same material, than the same shaped object made out of steel. When that radio wave is propagated into free space, 377 ohms per square, it wants to see nothing but. And when it encounters a chunk of wood, which has got a dielectric constant of 3, that's a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. It's a significant mismatch.
Repeater, time out.
A significant amount of signal will reflect off your 2x4. You may put chunks of fiberglass and all kinds of things at microwave frequencies in your anechoic chamber. And because they are insulating materials, you lull yourself into complacency and you think you've got transparent materials. Not at microwave frequencies. At microwave frequencies, that nothing is transparent except air or vacuum. Everything else is going to give you an echo. The only thing left to discuss is how big is the echo? Can you tolerate it? Can you make it smaller? Can you put anechoic material on it to absorb the signal that's hitting your insulating material that you think is non-reflective? Or can you calibrate it back out of the measurement? Those exact words that I'm saying right now, the first few times that I said it, boy, people thought I was really lost it. And it's a misunderstanding of how physics works. Whether you've got a piece of high dielectric material, like wood or plastic or fiberglass or whatever, in air, and you think it's transparent, at very low frequencies where it's an extremely small fraction of a wavelength, it is pretty transparent. By the time you get up to microwave frequencies, whether you make a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio by putting a chunk of 20-ohm coax in the middle of a 50-ohm cable, or whether you put a piece of 3-to-1 standing wave ratio wood in free space, in either case, the amount of echo you're going to get is almost the same. That's physics. And if there are further questions or comments on all of the above, and you're allowed to challenge it, KQRAW listening.
Oh, KC2QAQ. Just with a quick comment.
Glenn recognized. Is there anyone else who wants to add to all this? You've got it, Glenn.
I guess what actually happened with all this information, you know, that I was taking from the chamber, was the most useful piece of information I did get out of it was that with any one specific antenna that I was working with inside the chamber, what I was able to do was find a position where I was peaking, and it would go through the XYZ axes with the antenna, whichever one of the five that I was using inside there, find a peak position so that with the smallest amount of signal I was pumping into the antenna from the chamber, you know, from the generator outside the chamber, once I would find the correct position where it would peak out on the receiver, I would stop that position and hold that polarity. Then what I would do is back the signal down so that I could get a nice peaking amount on the analyzer of, like, say, around 70 dB microvolts. Very easy to see on the screen. And then if I would go in and make small adjustments to that specific antenna inside there that would start peaking it up or dropping it down, I could actually optimize that antenna while it was in that position. And then come back outside, check it again, and go back in and out a couple of times. Because interestingly enough, with all five of these antennas that I did that exact procedure with, when I brought them outside the chamber and did try them out in the field again, and used them on the 440 band, you know, I was surprised at what an improvement I could make so that the actual performance of all these different antennas weren't all that different when they were outside, once they were optimized in the outside real world. But it's that chamber to compare from antenna to antenna was extremely difficult. But to be able to peak them up in one polarity seems to be very, very useful information. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, two or three times you mentioned peaking the antennas. And there's two or three different ways, ambiguous things you could be saying there, Glenn. Either you were moving them in your pitch and roll, and trying to get the strongest response out of the G10 instrumentation, that's one definition, or you are making electrical changes to the antenna itself to tune it to the right frequency range. So there are two different ways you could be doing peaking. And when it comes to making the signal weak enough to get it within the dynamic range of your G10 network analyzer, usually that's not a problem. You can always put in fixed attenuators on the connectors, even if your variable attenuator on the signal generator with its amplifier will not go low enough. Quite often the G10 amplifier has got a signal source. The signal source for a G10 quite often is an oscillator followed by an amplifier, so that you can get the G10 up to numbers like 100 and 200 volts per meter to do susceptibility, RF susceptibility, radiated susceptibility tests. And in your case, you were using it as an antenna range where you wanted a much, much weaker signal. So attenuating should be easy as long as you do the attenuation in the right place. If you do the attenuating after the signal generator but before the amplifier, which means you're going to live with the noise coming out of the amplifier, that may not be the right place. As long as you can keep the signal low enough so it doesn't burn up your attenuators, you'd really like to attenuate right at the connector of the G10 after the amplifier. You've got to be careful with all these techniques. You'd be amazed whenever you try to simulate a radar and you try to simulate the peak envelope power of the radar. You've got this great signal generator. You've got this great pulsing network. You've got a great amplifier that's boosting up your signal so it equals the peak envelope power of the radar. And then you think you've got a hunky-dory test. You don't realize that every time you turn off your pulsing network, the amplifier is still sitting there with a 6 dB of noise figure and 40 dB of gain, and it's cranking out to 46 dB of TXS, and it's affecting your receiver sensitivity. A real radar removes all B-plus from its transmitting tube during the instant it is not transmitting. A real amplifier in your simulated radar does not do that. And the noise that you produce can really contaminate the daylight out of your test. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I completely agree. But the kinds of optimizations that I was making with the antennas are, let's talk about the quarter wave ground plane first. The first thing I found that I could fix the ground plane to give me more output signal for the same amount of input signal coming from a generator was to increase the thickness of the whip itself. In other words, what kind of diameter thickness of the whip. The other thing that would affect the amount of output that I was getting out of the antenna to really peak it up was to adjust the bushing thickness between the grounding plate, the ground plane plate, and how high the spacing was off of the plate. It turned out to be something like around a quarter of an inch. Go a little bit higher than that, half an inch. It would kind of like detune. I could change the length of the whip again to try to fix it, but it was like somewhere around a quarter inch off the plate with a nice nylon bushing. Really optimized it nicely. Then there was the half-wave dipole. The thickness there again turned out to be 10 gauge wire on 449. Why 10 gauge? Just at that length, it seemed to be nice. And the second thing that seemed to have given me the most peaked out signal was the spacing between where it was connected to the type N connector. There was spacing the wire off of the center pin seemed to be kind of critical. So in other words, by spacing the putting like a set of screws and washers that brought the wire closer to the pin on the output of the type N connector made a very, very big difference, peaked up the signal, and also worked very, very well when it came outside. On the loop antenna, the critical item was the thickness of the wire, and the other thing was the spacing of how close the balun could be placed to the loop itself. In other words, the secondary winding of the balun as it was getting placed to the outer loop of the wire. The closer I could get those two points together, seemed to give me the better possible signal. The further they were getting spaced apart, I was getting less signal out of the antenna. Very interesting stuff, but just interesting things I learned while working in that G10 chamber. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What kind of antenna are we building that we need that much science on it?
Yeah, John, good question, Alex. I've got a number of questions here, Glenn. First of all, you're trying to maximize the gain or performance or transmitted energy from these antennas. That I understand. Bear in mind that the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society defines gain of an antenna as that property you measure when there is no impedance mismatch on this transmission line. So in other words, standing wave ratio of the antenna is not part of this gain. If you know the amount of reflected energy you're getting off your antenna because of its standing wave ratio when you're transmitting into it, now let's assume that the 10% of the energy is being reflected instead of radiated because of Vizwa mismatch, and assume that that's a half a dB of difference. Well, you can crank out that half a dB on the measurement you've made is one approach, or you can really impedance match it. So, first of all, I am curious about the network analyzer you were using inside of the G10. Was it connected to your antenna on the test, and was it measuring S11, reflection voltage coefficient, or standing wave ratio? That's question number one. And two, if you peaked the antenna, impedance match, such that on a 50-ohm transmission line, for instance, it had essentially no reflected energy, minus 20 dB of S11, for instance, then any further changes to the antenna affecting its impedance match should not affect its radiating efficiency. When you went to 10-gauge wire on the quarter-wave ground plane, and you got more response out of the G-TAM, was that because you got a better impedance match, or was it because the fatter piece of wire closer to the metal plate that goes down the center of the G-TEM was giving you greater coupling to that metal plate? See, the G-TEM was not intended to be an antenna range. Therefore, there's a slim possibility here, Glenn, that it was showing you optimizations that maybe were not real. So, were you measuring this was my first main question. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, first changes that I would make would be, in other words, before I put the antennas inside the chamber, I was using a MFJ-269 antenna analyzer, where I could basically set it right at, 449 megahertz, and basically sweep right through it and make sure that I have a good match. I put it inside the chamber, I set the signal generator, and looked at the output that I was getting on the sweep. Then I opened up the chamber again, started making changes to the antenna, changed the wire gauge. But before, I would, make a change like changing wire gauge or spacing between, balun connections and things like that, I would always go back and make sure that the VSWR was matched back to 50 ohms before I closed the chamber, and then basically took another set of measurements. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When you increase the wire to 8 gauge, and you got more performance, what was the wire gauge before? And by the way, did the VSWR of the antenna outside the chamber change when you put it inside the chamber? I'm almost positive the answer was yes. I think there's a good chance because the G-TEM was being used as if it was an anechoic chamber, but it really is not. An awful lot of the echoes you were getting in the G-TEM are not what the G-TEM responds to. So, but the echoes off the forward and back wall. The door that you open, I'm going to call it the forward wall, and the back wall is what you see as you walk through that door. It really is on the side walls in both cases. The echoes that you get off of those are reflecting back to your antenna on the test and changing its apparent impedance match. So I'll bet you had to do a moderate amount of impedance rematching when you went from the outside world to the G-TEM world. That's question number one. And number two, what was the gauge of the wire of the quarter wave ground plane radiator before you changed it to 10 gauge? So back to you, Glenn.
Well, I think the first thing, Dick, is that these are very, very simple antennas. The first one is, it's a 6.6 and a quarter inch roughly high width on a piece of flat metal with a bushing and a small, you know, connector on the bottom. The same thing with the dipole. I mean, we're only talking about a 12.5-inch dipole. On the tables themselves where these things were being measured, as opposed to being outside, you know, from the floor and everything, there wasn't big VSWR changes. The real changes were in the physical changes I was making to the antenna, because, I mean, I wasn't coming within, you know, a foot or two of the floor. I mean, I was still, my chamber was still probably, you know, the better part of 30 inches away from any surface. So that really wasn't the issue there. VSWR matching to the analyzer was very much the same outside as it was, you know, sitting on these wooden tables and mounting them inside there. So, because I said the size of these antennas were very small. The difference in gauges of conductors that I was using for the elements were ranging anywhere from approximately, I think there was a 24-gauge wire where I started initially, because I was just, you know, taping it along pieces of fiberglass with a type N connector off the end. And then I started thickening it up, and, you know, eventually I went up to 10-gauge, and higher than that, actually. I think I went up to almost a 4-gauge wire thickness, you know, with a piece of metal in between and trying to tune that. And I found that there was a point where actually the signal started dropping off again, and each time, you know, I had to cut and rematch the VSWR before I put the sample back inside again. But so for some reason that I was finding around 10-gauge wire was giving me a very, very sweet performance for 449 megahertz. Why? I'm not really sure, but it's just that's where I was getting the best peak signals. Once the VSWR was set, I put it back inside the chamber, mounted it, checked the VSWR, then connected up the outside cable that was running, you know, through the chamber to the generator on the outside, and then I could see how much signal I needed to adjust the generator for to give me the performance on the scan. So that's basically the feedback and, making little adjustments to this antenna, but each time making sure before I ran the sample that the VSWR was 50 ohms matched to the cable again. And the reason I was so cognizant of the VSWR was because one of the first measurements I made in the beginning was to take a 50 ohm load and put it inside the chamber with the cable that was running through to make sure that as the cable was moving, repeater,
time out.
Timed out for about 30 seconds there, Glenn, and while you were talking about calibrating with the dummy load inside the chamber and that test. So we didn't miss too much. When you went from, let's say, 22-gauge wire on the quarter wave ground plane all the way up to either 8 or 4-gauge wire, give me a rough guess. Did you see a tenth of a dB increase or a decibel increase? There's a way you can quantify. You saw more performance out of the either 8 or 4 gauge wire for the quarter wave ground plane or the half wave ground plane. Roughly how much increase in performance did you see, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, keep in mind that the signal, the measurement is in dB microvolts, and I could see a difference between, there was once the, you know, I had the position that I knew where to work on the antenna in. I was seeing differences of as many as big as 20 dB microvolts by playing with wire gauges and spacing the bushings and things like that. So from the time that I first put the antenna inside the chamber, I think the closest antenna that I went into the chamber where I saw the least amount of changes by fixing wires and things like that was the loop. But on the quarter wave ground plane, that was the one, I would say, that with the plate on the bottom and adjusting the bushing height and the thickness of the metal, I could see as much as 20 dB microvolts difference just by playing with the bushing and the thickness of the metal. That was the most critical. The second most critical would have been the half wave dipole. That one, the spacing between how close it seemed, how can I put this in words? The center connector of the type N connector, the closer I could tune the antenna by bringing those two leads as close together as possible with the center fed match, seemed to give me the most amount of output signal from the antenna with the thickest piece of metal I could use as a radiator, if that makes any sense. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I would like to ask something, Glenn, Dick, with your permission.
Yeah, I've got a whole series of questions right now. You go ahead with your question first, because I'm gonna hit him with quite a series of questions. You got it, Alex.
Okay, Glenn, you have not described the antenna itself. I'm curious about the physical aspect of the antenna at the feeding point and the ground plane. How is the ground plane? It's just a flat plate? How do you attach the antenna to the ground plane? Describe in detail this point, the point between the ground plane and the antenna. Go ahead.
Oh, sure, absolutely. The piece of the ground plane itself is a piece of approximately 14 by 14 sheet of aluminum. It's a quarter of an inch thick. No, excuse me, I'm sorry, it's not a quarter, it's an eighth of an inch plate. And what I did was I drilled a hole in the center of this, and I put through a type end connector on one side and a 3/8 mount on the other side, which is separated from the plate by a bushing. It's an insulator bushing, so in other words, the ground ring of this connector, actually, the type-end connector, actually makes contact with the plate with a nut, and on the other side, there's a bushing in between the center pin to where it connects to a 3/8 mount on the top. Now, the 3/8 mount that screws into this top piece is maybe 1 inch tall, so when I'm measuring the height off the plate to the antenna, I can cut and trim wire gauges inside this little fitting, it's on the top, where I can use an Allen key screw and tighten it in, and basically adjust the height and trim it on the plate so I get a 50 ohm mesh. Now I can adjust thicknesses and get very, very thin pieces of stainless steel that were very, very close to like 24 gauge wire, and I had very, very fat, thick pieces that were close to, say, like an 8 gauge wire in circumference or thickness, diameter of this material. And each time, the fatter the width, each time I had to trim the width and then adjust it for height again, because obviously it was a different length for each thickness on that plate. And then I started noticing that, thicker antennas were starting to give me better output signal. And the other thing that I had adjusted was the bushing height between the center connection to the plate as the type end connector went through the plate with the tightening nut. N2NNU, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I have one more question and then I'm going to make my comment. Glenn, do you expect your antenna to be mounted on a flat surface that will serve as a ground plane?
Well, this antenna, as I said, it was just a plate. It's a very simple antenna. It was just a plate and basically a whip. So with a little bushing running through the center. And the idea was just to kind of be able to have a test sample that I could carry that wasn't all that large, that I could kind of like strap down onto a plate and make measurements on it and see what it would do, and then kind of take it outside and see how it would perform. N2NNU, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so this antenna is not representative of something that will be used in real life. First of all, you have to make sure that the transition from the connector to the antenna is actually 50 ohms. The hole and the spacing of the pin between the in the hole have to be represented by 50 ohms. In other words, the pin thickness and the hole in which it's placed into the pin of the connector and the hole in which it's placed on the plate have to have specific diameters to represent the 50 ohm transmission point. Second of all, I will suggest you to, rather than using a flat plane, use a conical 45 degree angle metal plate. You will be surprised what a difference it makes. In other words, use a cone rather than a flat plate. That gets into geometrical mathematics and whatnot, but That is the way I would test this particular antenna. That's it.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions here, Glenn. And by the way, curving the plate so it looks like you're sitting on top of a very shallow pyramid, so that the metal plate curves away, very similar to the three radials on, say, a station master antenna. That does help the impedance match. And when it comes to whether or not the feed through the metal plate from the type N connector into the antenna, whether or not 50 ohms is maintained along that length, there's at least two schools of thought on there. Yes, if you maintain 50 ohms throughout that length, life becomes easier. However, if you're willing to do impedance matching by length changing and putting in a shunt reactor, you can always get a perfect impedance match. So that becomes a little bit academic if you're smart enough. But here's my real question, Glenn. When I measure decibels on well-calibrated laboratory test equipment, whether I'm measuring dBm, dBv, dBmv, dB with reference to current, dB with reference to a watt, with reference to a milliwatt, a decibel is a decibel is a decibel. If the instrumentation is well calibrated, no matter what system of units I measure that is apparently equivalent to a power measurement, I could be measuring voltage and knowing the impedance converted into power, or I could be measuring real power in milliwatts, volts, whatever, milliwatts or watts and so on. When you measured 20 dBmv of difference between when you started tuning and when you finished tuning, and if the standing wave ratio outside the chamber was reasonable to begin with and reasonable when you finished, and assuming you're using reasonably lossless materials, you're not plugging in resistors, you're not using stainless steel, which is a pretty lossy material, you're using real copper for the radiator, and you're using real aluminum for the sheet of the ground plane, you have essentially lossless materials from what I'm hearing. And you made a difference of 20 dBmv between the beginning and the ending on, say, the quarter wave ground plane. Let's just talk about the quarter wave ground plane. Do you believe that that is a 20 decibel difference in
repeater timeout?
Do you believe that that represents, assuming the instrumentation is telling you the truth, 20 decibels of change, 20 dBmv units, but it's 20 decibels of change between the time you began tuning and when you ended tuning? Do you believe that that represents 20 decibels of gain difference when that antenna is used in free space before and after your tuning procedure? KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, let me put it to you this way. If I learned one thing that this whole exercise taught me, was that if you build a loop antenna, from this experiment, at least at 449 megahertz, there is very little way to screw it up. it's so... You can really make a lot of adjustments to the antenna, and it's going to perform pretty well, and you can use a lot of different gauges of wire and things, and I think at like an 18, wait, let me see, for like a 26-inch piece of wire, roughly, that I was using, you just tune it with a ballon on the other side, I don't think that there's too much you can do to it to really screw it up. You can you can use a wide variety of materials. The second closest to where it's almost impossible to screw up, very little changes, would be on the half-wave dipole, as to when it's center-fed. There isn't a whole, I mean, there's a little bit of playing around with wire gauges and things like that, and when you compare it to how much power I had to put into the generator, you know, I'm talking maybe 3 dB difference in terms of, you know, change in dBm into the generator to get the same reading on the, in dB microvolts. But the one antenna that I can tell you now, from just having a good 50-ohm match, bringing it in the chamber, and just playing around with bushings and thicknesses of the antenna, that you can really screw up big time, is a quarter wave ground plane, KC2QIQ.
Let me remind him about height versus width ratio, Dick.
Okay, he was going from
a skinny radiator like a 18 or 20 or 22 gauge to fat radiator like 8 gauge or more, and assuming it's a good conducting material. Let's just talk about the quarter wave ground plane all by itself. Make believe you didn't do any testing on a half wave diode.